This podcast is brought to you by BetRivers. Download the BetRivers app from the App Store or Google Play Store. Must be 21. Available in Ohio only. Void where prohibited. Terms and conditions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Sports gaming is provided in partnership with Dayton Real Estate Ventures, LLC, DBA, Hollywood Gaming at Dayton Raceway.
If you're a tennis fan, you'll love Betting Weekly Game Bet Match on the BetRivers Network. Whether you're a bettor or just love tennis, you'll enjoy the in-depth analysis each week of the tennis calendar. Subscribe to Game Bet Match today from your favorite podcast provider. It's the Mike Francesa Podcast on the BetRivers Network.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the Mike Francesa Podcast on what is a very, very busy time. A lot going on, early April. Baseball now is into its regular ritual, although the weather's going to dart in and out here, especially in New York next couple of days with a lot of rain. We'll start with that. We have the Final Four set. If you need a little college basketball, we have the NIT semis tonight, which is not bad, and they actually presented a pretty good NIT this time. And right around the corner, we have the NFL draft, and it is coming up as really one of the most anticipated and chock full of storylines. This draft has probably got more to offer than any draft that I can remember. There's a lot of intrigue. There's a lot of intrigue about trades at the top of the draft. There's a lot of intrigue about quarterback order at the top of the draft. It's a chock full draft of quarterbacks, wide receivers, offensive tackles. So that's going to be the premium in the first 15 picks. Quarterbacks are going to run, then wide receivers are going to run, and then tackles are going to run. That's how it's going to work. And you're going to throw a couple of edge guys and a tight end and a couple of different things sprinkled in along the way. So we'll get to that too. And then, as I said, one of the great rites of spring, one of the really great sporting events in the world, the Masters, will come your way next Thursday. And thankfully, it's a rare time where you have all the best players in the world in one place on one course. And that obviously has become a very, very rare event now in the very disjointed and divided world of professional golf. But let's start with baseball. Let's start with the high note. How the West was won. That is the Yankee story of this early season. When you looked at the schedule, no one was happy. Four in Houston, three in Arizona before they come home to open the season. Tough road trip, always tough in Houston. They win four close games, come from behind, do a great job. And then last night, jump out against the Diamondbacks and roll to a 5-2 win, big game for Volpe. Okay. Gill showed some very good stuff over his stint. So the Yankees now, for just the third time, are 5-0 to start a campaign. So all the misery of last year, all the misery and all the tough stuff that went on in that brutal 82-80 season has now been cast aside with this 5-0 start, and the fast start for Soto and the fast start for Volpe and the fast start for Cabrera and the other things that have gone on here. But just to sprinkle in some realism and bring it back down to earth, the last time the Yankees finished, opened 5-0 was 1992. That was a significant season. It was a losing season. They didn't make the playoffs. Not only that, they were 76-86. It was the end of the losing. It was the end of the Stump Merrill era. As a matter of fact, Buck Showalter managed that team. And it was the last year before the Yankees returned to winning ways, which would come in the 90s. They won in 93. In 94, in the strike abbreviated year, they had the second best record in baseball. They would have gone to the playoffs. They might have gone to the World Series. We know what happened. And then in 96, they won it all, and the rest, as we say, over the last 25 to 30 years has been history. But that was a losing season. So before you get giddy, remember the last time they opened 5-0, 1992. They finished 76-86. Does that mean anything for this year? Of course not. But what I'm saying is one five-game stretch does not make a season. Now, when it opens the season, it's a huge positive. Hey, the Yanks jumping out, having a star player, a superstar player, come to a team and perform so well early is highly unusual. Does not happen. Usually they feel the pressure. They feel the pressure of the new city, the pressure to perform, the whole thing. Not happens with Soto. He has gotten off unbelievably. And the biggest improvement looks to be Volpe at the plate. Now, it's too early to say it's a fact, but you have to like all the indicators you are seeing right now. While the Yankees are 5-0 and riding high as they complete their domination in the West before they come home to open the season later this week, things have gotten uglier and uglier for the Mets. As we said, if there was a team that could not afford to open the season in a very bad way, it was the Mets. There was so much doubt about the roster. There was so much doubt about the starting rotation. There was so much doubt about the lineup and the direction of the team that they needed to get off fast. Now, that's not usually been a problem for the Mets because they've usually, you know, found a way to win on opening day. That didn't happen this year. They got one hit. They got swept by the Brewers. And then last night, they get a terrific game out of Manaea, but they can't score. And the Mets lose the game in extra innings, get shut out, and now they're 0-4. I told you last week, the Mets needed to get off to a pretty fast start in the first nine because what was coming. They haven't done that. They're 0-4. The quartet of Lindor, Nimmo, McNeil, and Stewart are 3-51. Yes, 3-51. To say they have all collectively gotten off poorly, well, would be the understatement. Two of them are 1-16. One's 1-12, and the other one's 0-7. That is a disaster, and it has led them to where they are right now at 0-4. But the problem is, when you look at the Mets schedule, you can now think about some real ugliness that could be waiting by the end of this month. The Mets have two more games, weather permitting, with the Tigers. Today's iffy. Tomorrow is probably a washout. They go to Cincinnati for 3. Okay. They can compete with Cincinnati. We know that. But then they go to Atlanta for 4. Then they come home, they play the Royals, who are improved, and the Pirates, who are right now 5-0. Now, before you start thinking this is their, you know, the new lumber company, Pitt is improved. How much so? We're going to find out, but they are improved. Then comes a trip to LA to take on the Dodgers and a trip followed by a stop in San Francisco, which is never pleasant for the Mets. So the Mets now, at already 0-4, are facing a Tiger team that has gotten off hot. They go to Cincinnati for 3. They go to Atlanta for 4. They come home, they have 6 games against the Royals and the Pirates. And then they go to L.A., and San Francisco. So by April 23rd, between now and April 23rd, the Mets will play 10 road games in Atlanta, LA, and San Francisco, and they're already 0-4. By the time that last game in the Giants series is in the books, the Mets will have played 4, 6, 9, 13, 16, 19, 20 to 25 games. You could be looking in that with a record that could be scary after 25 games. Scary. It would be April 23rd. They would have played 25 games. And now at 0-4, with 10 road games against teams that they don't match up with. Going to Atlanta for 4, going to Dodger Stadium for 3, going to San Francisco for 3. This could get very, very ugly. And with each passing day, it gets worse. You know, they can all... Now, I watched last night the manager. I haven't seen anything in the manager yet. You know, he's very low-key in these press conferences. I mean, you don't see anything yet. It's only 4 games. But this is, I guarantee you, getting to them already. Lindor stood there and said, I really thought tonight there was a great spirit, not like yesterday. Well, you're telling me yesterday, the 3rd game of the season, was already a problem? Forget what you told me tonight. You're telling me yesterday was a problem? It's only the 3rd game of the season. This will play on this team very, very quickly. And as I've said many times in sports, you want to get that first one. Oh, you want to get that first hit, that first home run, that first win as a manager. You want to get all that in your pocket and done with. It's why I always say that on the opening drive of an NFL game, I don't care if it's 4th and 1/4 inch. I am kicking the field goal on the first drive. I want the 0 off the board. Because I've seen so many times when you don't take it off the board when you can, sometimes it's up there for a very long time. And it becomes harder and harder and harder to erase. And that's what happens now. Hey, you knew in this season there was going to be a 4-game losing streak or even a longer than 4-game losing streak. But you don't want to have it out of the box. You don't want to have it when you have a new manager, a new regime, and you're trying to sell something that really isn't there to your fan base. Cohen tried to sell them before this. Hey, listen, you know, I'm not going to give you a record, but our goal is to make the playoffs. All right, you can sneak into the playoffs with a lousy record, the way the playoffs are set up now. So that possibility exists. The idea is not to have a lot of teams eliminated by Labor Day, which is what they did this for. But the worst thing that could have happened has happened. They opened badly. And now, I don't care what they say, they've already had an injury to join the Senga injury in the rotation. They got half the lineup, which has done absolutely nothing. So you got guys already pressing. And don't tell me they're not, because they are. They already know and hear it from the fans, and they're going to start to hear it. It's going to get compounded. And then you're looking down the barrel at a schedule that is not conducive to anything good over the next couple of weeks. His first 9 games against Milwaukee, Detroit, and Cincinnati were an opportunity to get off and get a little cushion before you were going to see Atlanta and the Dodgers and San Francisco all on the road. And after that, you're looking at Atlanta again before the month's over. You're looking at Toronto. You're looking at Tampa. It's not pretty. The Phillies. This thing could get very, very ugly very early. And at 0-4, it needs to stop right now. If they hit the road at 0-6, you don't know where this is going. They need a win. Now, they got a game last night that, you know, listen, pitcher can't pitch any better. They got 9 shutout innings. They couldn't put up a run. And then they got pounded in the 10th. But this team, you can see it already. And watch, it is going to be palpable what you're going to see in the next couple of days. They need a win, and they need it badly. They need it right now so that everyone can stop talking about this. And it's just going to, it is going to mushroom with each passing loss now. Because now it's not 0-1, it's not 0-2, it's already 0-4. In a season where a bad start will crush this team, crush it for the season. There will be no season. And, of course, conversely, across town, you know, they're popping corks already with this Yankee team. I mean, the Yankee fans are, you know, hey, they had such a bad year last year that they just wanted something to get giddy about, and they've already gotten real giddy. And you're hearing crazy things. But, hey, ignore that stuff. This will all level off. But they've gotten off to a good start, something they don't do that often. And that's a positive because it just gives you a little cushion. You're only in to, when you realize it's 162 games. Until you've played 20% of the season, there's really nothing to talk about. But bad starts matter because good starts can make people buy in, and it just creates positive force and energy. Bad starts do the exact opposite. They tear things down. They create doubt. They create division. And they create despair. And that can come very quickly, as early as April. Bad things happen to baseball teams in April. Bad things happen to managers in April. 0-4 is enough. Now, as I mentioned, the Final Four set for Saturday. The two big teams, heavily favored, as you would expect. All right? I mean, we'll be surprised if they don't both win. I went with a UConn-Purdue championship game. It's what I wanted. It's what I'm really hoping for because I want to see the two big men square off, even though I know that the UConn supporting cast is better. Does Alabama have a chance against UConn? I picked Alabama to get to the Final Four. It was a pretty lucky. It was a process of elimination pick. I'm not banging the drum about it. But they've done a great job, and they could shoot the three. But they don't match up at all with Connecticut. Not at all. If they try and run with them, which they will because it's the only game they play, Connecticut will score 100 and win by 20. That's the second game. Connecticut is a 11.5-point favorite, and who knows, could be 13 by game time. You know, Connecticut's covered every point spread. So has Purdue. The favorites have done very well in this tournament. And NC State is a 9.5-point underdog. And this is a bad matchup for NC State. Not just because of the big man, but the big man's presence will negate their greatest strength. So we'll get into the X's and O's later in the week, but hey, nobody's expecting, let's be honest, nobody's expecting NC State to win, although people will give them, you'll see a couple of people step out and back them, and I don't think anybody's going to back Alabama. I really want to see UConn play Purdue because I think it's the only obstacle left for UConn. I think they're going to beat Alabama 100-80. They're going to kill them on the backboards. They're going to kill them with second chances. Alabama will have their moments when they spray some threes, but UConn's going to spray more and kill him inside. Kill him. I mean, kill him inside. And they have the athletes who can go up and down the court. You see, they have no weakness. Purdue has a couple of weaknesses. Every team in college basketball has weaknesses, except UConn. They have none. Now, I mentioned if you're desperate for some college basketball, you got it tonight in the NIT. And it's a pretty good doubleheader. They're playing it in Indiana. Indiana State will have a lot of fans there. They're playing a good Utah team. You have Indiana State, which is, if you haven't seen them, this is a team, they got beat by Drake in their conference final, a team that was the highest team in terms of real basketball ratings that didn't get into the NCAA tournament. This team belonged in the NCAA tournament, just like Seton Hall belonged in the NCAA tournament. Now, the one thing about this NIT Final Four is that these four teams want to win. These four teams really care. They're motivated to win this title. And that's the biggest thing you look for in the NIT is first motivation. You have to figure out whether the big schools, now some schools said, I'm not going. You know, St. John said, I'm not going. Pittsburgh said, I'm not going. Oklahoma said, we're not interested. Okay. They felt it wasn't right for their program. That's fine. For the teams that went here, these four teams, three of them were legitimate. Utah, if they didn't play badly late, would have been in the NCAA tournament. Indiana State, it was a surprise that they weren't in the NCAA tournament because they got beat by Drake. Georgia has surprised people because they wouldn't even have got into the NIT if everybody had been in who they invited. They weren't even in the first invitation list. They were in because of the schools that backed out. But they've done really well as a couple of times as a big underdog. They've done really well in the NIT. They get a Seton Hall team, which is taking this very seriously and is going to be very tough to beat in this game. I like Seton Hall over Georgia. I think they play really hard. I think they play tough. They play very physical. They're well coached. Richmond can give you, he can score off the bounce. He can go inside and score. Dawes will kill you. He's the guy you got to stop with. You know, you got to stop Dawes because he'll just, you know, he'll bury you from the outside. He'll bury you from three, and he'll do it in a streaky way. So I think that game, I like Seton Hall over Georgia. I think they'll win by, you know, 7 to 10 points. The other game's going to be a close game. The problem is, Indiana State's a pretty team. They run a really sweet offense. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's really pretty. But Utah's enormous. That is a big, big team. And they have a guard who's been red hot in the tournament. He's averaged 20 points. He's been red hot. So they got it inside. They got it outside. Indiana State's a 3.5-point favorite, and the crowd will be enormously Indiana State. As a matter of fact, there'll probably be a big crowd for the Indiana State game. They'll probably all leave, and there won't be a lot of fans there because I guarantee you Seton Hall and Georgia didn't travel hauling anybody to the game. So that first game's going to be tight. I'd have to take the points with Utah. I'm rooting for Indiana State. I'd like to see a Seton Hall-Indiana State final. Indiana State's a 3.5-point favorite. If I had to play that game, I don't love the game. If I had to play that game, I'd take Utah. The second game, I'd take Seton Hall. They're a 4-point favorite. Now, as I mentioned, this is a great time of year because you've gotten through the winter. You're waiting, especially here in the Northeast, for the spring weather to hit. I mean, this week, the weather's rainy and cold and dreary. So, you know, it's the first week in April. You want to get going. You want to be able to hit the golf course. You haven't been able to do anything out here. I mean, it's just been bad. Next week, they say it's going to be nicer. We'll see. But you have these annual rites of spring. Baseball is one, and the other, of course, is the Masters. Then you have the NBA and the NHL playoffs coming, which will be a lot of fun. And you have what is a compelling NFL draft. And incredibly compelling about, interesting here for the New York teams because of where they draft and what the needs are. But very interesting from the quarterback standpoint. Now, you know Williams is going first. I think everyone's known that all along. They got very little for Fields, I think, which surprised them. But Williams was going to be the pick. There's some guys who have cast doubt on him, not from a talent standpoint. His attitude, some of the things that he says and does, kid can play. Then it gets very interesting because teams are moving all along and you're hearing all this stuff. This team, oh, they are a Daniels team. This team, oh, they love May. Oh, this team, oh, they are in on McCarthy. McCarthy's moved up so much, he could go to number two. So you don't even know which one of these. You figure this. You got the best, probably the best all-around player in the whole draft in Marvin Harrison Jr. sitting there. You want to say he's going to go four. You're not positive because somebody could trade up and get a quarterback there too. Quarterbacks rule. So even a player like Harrison could slip. The first team that sees Harrison on the board that didn't expect him to be there is grabbing him. So do the Pats take Harrison at three? Do they trade the pick? Do they take a quarterback? They don't take him at three. He's gone at four, but does Arizona trade out of that spot for a team that wants a quarterback? And now Harrison's dropped down. And does he get taken next? Or does somebody have a distinct need there? I don't see any way that he lasts five picks. I don't think it's humanly possible that he lasts five picks. I think he's too good. But the quarterbacks, I think, are going off the board one, two, three. I think the third one's probably going to be a trade. I think Minnesota's made it pretty clear that they're going to do whatever they have to do to get up into the three spot. So I think there's a good chance the Pats trade. And then Minnesota takes a quarterback there. But you have Williams one, and then you have May, Daniels, and McCarthy. They're all going to be gone by the time the Giants pick at six. If they don't, what are the Giants doing at six? Well, they're either going to shock the world and take a quarterback, which I don't think they're doing. I think they're going to take a wide receiver. Now, if they're presented with all the wide receivers at six, and I don't think Harrison will make it to six. If he's on the board, despite how fast Neighbors is, despite how much you might like Adunze, you have to take Marvin Harrison Jr. He's that good. I don't think he will be on the board when the Giants pick. I do not think he will. I think the Giants will take a wide receiver at six. I would be surprised if they don't. And then you're back. Then you're going to get to run on wide receivers, but you also can find someone who also wants to get into the before 10 and take another quarterback. Now we're figuring, it's interesting. If the four quarterbacks go off the board, one, two, three, four, that means Harrison's still on the board. If Harrison goes off earlier because someone was playing possum and they were really going to take Harrison, that means a quarterback slides down. You know the Chargers aren't taking a quarterback. Everyone thinks they're taking an offensive lineman, but what if one of those great wide receivers is there? Harbaugh might not pass him up. So it gets very, very interesting because you have 1-2, you know you're going quarterbacks. Okay, that's not an issue. That's not really debatable. Okay, 1-2, you're going quarterbacks. You know that going in. 3-4, so many things are possible. The teams can trade out of the draft there. They can take quarterbacks. Now, they can move players. I mean, there's so many things that can happen there that it makes it fascinating, okay? I don't think Washington's going to do anything except take a quarterback. Which quarterback they're going to take depends who you listen to. I think the Pats will trade out of that pick. I don't think they'll take a quarterback. I think they could surprise everybody and take Harrison. If not, I think they'll probably trade the pick, and it's more likely Minnesota goes in there. If they don't, Minnesota could go into the 4 spot for Arizona. Then you have the Chargers, and they're going to take the best player that's there. You know, they're either going to – I think Harbaugh figures, hey, if Marvin Harrison's there, I'm going to take him. If he's not there, I'm going to take Alt. We know they're not taking a quarterback. So I think he's either going to take a wide receiver or Alt there. I don't think anybody else goes that high. I think no one's off the board. Alt could go off the board there. And then the Giants, who are going to take – now, everyone thinks Giants could shock everyone and take a quarterback who's still left. Or the 4 quarterbacks already off the board. And I would think with them, I expect them to go wide receiver. If it gets to the Jets, and I know everyone's in love with Bowers, and listen, I think Bowers can be a really good tight end. I've watched him in college. He's going to be a very good player in the pros. But as I've stated time and time again, and stated since the day the season ended with the Jets, that they had to go out and get offensive linemen in free agency, which they did. You know how much I screamed about getting Smith, and they got him. So people are saying now they don't need to draft. Yes, they do. They need to draft another tackle. First of all, Smith is not young, and he's injury prone. So you know, they need to take that pick and take a tackle. There's good tackles there. They need to take a tackle at 10. I understand they like the tight end. They don't need the tight end there. They need a tackle. They need one more premium offensive lineman. That's the play for them. And then they have gone out and built some depth, hopefully some versatility and some toughness, and they went and got a guy who's a Hall of Fame-level player at left tackle. You say, well, he never plays. Well, last year he played a lot, and he was the number one pass blocker in the league. And he played 960-some-odd snaps. I understand he's had injuries. Cowboys couldn't afford him. I mean, they loved him. He's one of Jerry Jones' favorite players. But they couldn't pay him. They didn't want to lose him. Nobody would want to lose a guy that good. But has there been a question of time about him playing? Yeah, he gets hurt. No question. If he didn't, you couldn't have touched him. He would have never got cut. And then, so it's going to be quarterbacks, then it's going to be wide receivers, then it's going to be offensive tackles, and you're going to throw in, Bowers is going to get taken in probably in round 10 and or 12, and then you're going to have a couple of edge guys get taken, like Atlanta's going to take an edge guy. That's going to be your early part of your draft. But the question is, where are these quarterbacks going in what order after Williams? May, Daniels, McCarthy. And then when does somebody go and reach for the tandem of Nix and Penix Jr.? Do they go higher than we think and somebody likes them? Somebody likes one of those two and grabs them inside 15? Or do they get taken in the later part of the first round, or do they fall to the second round? You have, this is one quarterback ranking. Doesn't mean you agree with it, don't agree with it. Williams, May, Daniels, McCarthy, Nix, Penix Jr., Rattler, Spencer Rattler from South Carolina, put up some big numbers, and Pratt from Tulane, who's 6'3", 220, and ran a good offense. Michael Pratt. Those are the top eight quarterbacks. And the first four of them are predicted to be going that any one of those, Williams is going one, that's a foregone conclusion. May, Daniels, McCarthy could go in any order. Some people have talked about McCarthy going as high as two now. I don't think he's going to. I think he could go three in a trade to somebody. Or four. I think there's a good, distinct possibility that teams trade into the three slot and the four slot in this draft. There's a lot of talk about trades right now. A lot of talk. More than normal. The most, this year reminds me of Eli's year. And there was no question there was going to be movement at the top, and there was going to be quarterbacks at the top, and there were going to be big trades at the top. I think we're looking at the same thing this year. And we didn't know the night before when things started to... Now, we didn't know until that morning, because we did that draft, and we didn't know until that morning. But the night before, you heard serious rumblings about what was coming down. And I remember, you know, the Giants, they were like, we want Eli, but we can live with Hostetler. I mean, Hostetler. Roethlisberger, excuse me. Hostetler. They could live with Roethlisberger. They liked Roethlisberger. So we could have that kind of intrigue right up to the draft. And when you're dealing with quarterbacks and trades, there's going to be so many rumors. But don't buy into, as I've said to you all along, do not buy into anybody telling you. First of all, people were telling you the Bears weren't going to draft him number one. Anyone who said that was completely foolish. Williams was going number one in this draft forever. It was never a day in the last 2 years when he was not going to be the first player picked in this draft. There's not been a day when that wasn't going to happen. And it never was an issue. The Bears were just trying to play it up, and they didn't play it well because they did not get a good trade for him. The market fell out completely for Fields. And I got to tell you, Fields isn't great from the pocket. I don't know if he ever will be, but he really isn't. He's got a lot to do. He's got a lot of work to do. So he was a project, there's no question. And this kid, he's quirky. Guys from the West Coast scare people. But he is very talented. I don't think anybody disputes that. Now, as I said, the other event, and I know I look forward to this all year. I can't wait for the Masters. Now, golf is a mess. Scotty Scheffler, who I really like a lot, has been dominating. He's been dominating, too, because, hey, look at the guys who aren't there. You know, Rahm's not there. Kepka's not there. Dustin Johnson's not there. DeChambeau's not there. I mean, it's killing the sport. They have to put the sport back together. They desperately have to put the sport back together. They have messed this up. I mean, they had a commissioner who lied right to their faces, who they couldn't trust as far as they could throw him, who messed things up on so many levels. And this thing has gone so badly in so many ways. There's animosity all the way down the line. And listen, if you're a player who stayed, you want the players who went and picked up the big money whether they were the guys who got the big check like Koepka or Dustin Johnson, forget what Rahm got or what Mickelson got. But there were guys who left and got $25 million who were top 100 players. But the depth of the talent has been so damaged. And golf has been, as a product, has been completely, I don't want to say destroyed because that's too strong a word, but really hampered. It has really hurt the sport from a viewing standpoint enormously. When you see a leaderboard and you don't see Rahm on it, and you don't see Koepka on it, and you don't see Dustin Johnson on it, or, you know, DeChambeau, who, you know, whether you like him or not, he made things interesting. They need to put these guys back together. Now, for next week, they'll all be there. That's the great thing about the Masters. Plus, it's a very select field. You know, there's not a lot of players. The Masters field is much shorter than the other tournaments. Because they don't invite a lot of people. And they like it that way. And it makes it a very select field. Now, Scheffler's going to be – these are the updated as of – we're a week away. Starts a week from Thursday. You always have the final four the Monday night and then right into Augusta on Thursday from the Monday. Monday night, you're thinking about the Masters, which will start on Thursday. Scottie Scheffler, who has played so brilliantly, is 4-1. He is a heavy favorite. The next favorite, and these are the Bet Rivers odds. And remember, go to the Bet Rivers app during this very busy time and download the Bet Rivers app for all of your wagering needs, everything you need there, plus all the little things they give you, all the bonuses they give you, all the promos they have for you, all the contests they have for you, everything else. So go to the Bet Rivers app for all of your wagering needs. Now, these are the updated Masters odds as of this morning. Scottie Scheffler, 4-1. 4-1 is a heavy favorite. And you realize the next player is 10-1. And that's Rory McIlroy. Now, Rory shouldn't be the second favorite. He hasn't won a major in so long, and he just doesn't putt well enough to win these tournaments. That's all there is to it. He's 10-1. The defending champion, who we miss, John Rahm is 12-1, and that is a – now, going back-to-back to Masters is anything but easy. But John Rahm at 12-1 is a generous offering. Now to 20-1, you have Koepka, who finished second last year, tied with Mickelson. Last year, and guys who play well at Augusta play well at Augusta. Rahm, Koepka, Mickelson, Henley, Reed, Spieth, Hovland, Young, Thigala, Shoffley. That was a top 10 last year. What do you notice about that? They're pretty much all big players. Rahm, Koepka, Mickelson, Reed, Spieth, Hovland, Young, Shoffley. It's all big players. So Koepka and Shoffley are 20-1. Jordan Spieth is 20-1, usually plays very well there. Zalatoris, who you got to worry a little bit about his back, but seems like he's playing healthy now, 22-1, very talented young player. Cantley, 25-1. Victor Hovland, an incredibly generous 25-1, but he has not played well this year. Wyndham Clark, who has played well this year, 25-1. Matsuyama, who has played well this year at 28-1. Cameron Smith, who always dangerous there, 28-1. Dustin Johnson. Remember Dustin Johnson? You know, any tournament that doesn't have Dustin Johnson is hurt by not having him. 33-1. You think, how does Dustin Johnson been playing? Well, I'm not going to use the LIV tournaments to set up whether I like him in the Masters or not. Dustin's 33-1. DeChambeau, 40-1. Fitzpatrick, who can putt up a storm, 40-1. Murakawa, a very generous 40-1. Tommy Fleetwood, who has never won on American soil despite that beautiful swing, 50-1. Max Homa, 50-1. And a couple of guys you might remember. A guy named Phil, who, remember, was right there last year behind Rahm. 100-1. And Tiger Woods, scheduled to play on the board, just to show you how things have changed. Phil is 100-1, Tiger's 125-1. Shows you that time keeps moving when Phil is 100-1 and Tiger's 125-1. The two players who were dominant in a generation. Well, Tiger on his own level, and then Phil, who, hey, has had a, whether you're happy with Phil or unhappy with Phil, Phil's had a brilliant career. And has always loved Augusta and plays well at the Masters, as last year indicated. Can Phil still put together four rounds and win Augusta? Yes, he could. Can Tiger? No. I don't even know if Tiger can play four rounds. Tiger cannot win the tournament anymore. Not with that racked body. He can't do it. I don't even know if he can play four rounds. You know, usually by the end of the second round, he's limping around. His back, his legs, everything. I mean, everything's a problem. Everything is a problem. But it is a terrific time of year because you got wall-to-wall action. You know, you got baseball. You got Final Four coming up. You got the Masters coming up. You look down the road, you're going to have, hey, imagine this town in May with the Knicks this year. This Knicks team, which is so likable, with Brunson leading the way and playing, you know, Villanova North, you want to call them, okay? They are playing so well. That Garden will be jumping, and there's nothing like a Knicks Friday night in May, a Friday night playoff game at the Garden. The place just resonates. There's nothing like that building. I don't care where you go. That building has no equal. And that's not a New York biased nonsense. Hey, it's the Garden. No one else has the Garden. It's Madison Square Garden. And when the Knicks are playing well and they have a guy playing like a big star, like a superstar, and they have a chance in these playoff rounds, hey, that place will be rocking. Nothing like it. I mean, if I missed one thing, it's the energy and the excitement that we had when Riley was with the Knicks, and the Knicks were so big, so popular, and mattered so much. I can't tell, you know, how many Friday nights, how many Sunday afternoons in May where you get out of that game, it's 12 o'clock game, 12:30 game, and you get out and you're walking down the street and it's sunny and it's a beautiful afternoon and you're walking out after a big playoff game. But as nice as that is, the ones that really stick with you are the night games, because it's a different sound. It's a different feel. It's a different anticipation. And it's an adult crowd in the night games. And we might have some of that this year. Great expectations for the Rangers. Great expectations for the Knicks. That's going to make it a very interesting time around here. And now the Yankees, who, hey, they came into the season with some issues. They still have issues. The issues haven't been cleared up. They have issues. They got some guys in the lineup you worry about. You worry about Rizzo. You worry about LeMayu. All right, Cabrera's doing a great job right now. But you worry about LeMayu. You worry about Rizzo. You worry about Stanton. You worry about Judge. And you worry about that pitching staff. Hey, let's be honest. Holmes got two saves in Houston where he could. It's a miracle he didn't get losses in both games. He got hit hard in both games. Soto, who is not a guy who throws people out through the runaround at the plate. And on Sunday, Birdie makes an incredible play on Altuve. The Alvarez ball somehow goes foul down the left field line. He doesn't get all of it, so it goes to the middle of the track in dead center field rather than go over the fence. And then Verdugo makes a nice catch in left field on a line drive by Tucker. Sometimes you're on a roll, and right now the Bombers are on one as they get ready for game six of How the West Was Won in Arizona with a 5-0 record. And on the other side, yes, hey, we are pulling for the Mets to come out of this malaise. Today is not too soon. Because if they hit the road and they haven't tasted victory, I fear this team just unraveling very quickly. If there was a team anywhere that did not need a terrible start, it was this Met team. Because they were trying to sell you something that probably wasn't there. They were hoping it would come together, but a terrible start. And look at what's coming, you know. 10 road games, Atlanta, Dodgers, Giants. Are they ready for that? Is that starting rotation ready for that? And instead of getting off with a little cushion, they could get off 2-7. Hey, 2-7 might be, you might sign for 2-7 right now. They're 0-4. You might sign for 2-7. 2-7 might be optimistic. It's 0-4. Might be rooting for a rainout by tomorrow. We'll see you later.
Thanks for listening to the Mike Francesa podcast on the Bet Rivers Network.